All right, everyone. Well, welcome to a special episode of the Camp House Podcast. Social distancing, COVID-19 style, recording from my house. So hopefully this audio comes out well. I really have no idea. And I just felt like it's an important moment to get a podcast out about something. And I'm actually doing a video right now, too, that I'll probably post on my own social media channels as well as the Camp House. And if you're watching the video, you'll notice that at the moment I'm wearing a collar. And so for those of you at the Camp House who have known me in my role as the director of the Camp House, I'm also a pastor at the Mission Chattanooga. And there's a couple of reasons I'm wearing my collar now. Number one is I've got a lot of recordings to do right after this for the church for our Sunday services. But far more seriously, I think it's really important that right now I don't separate the work of the Camp House from the work of the Mission Chattanooga when it comes to the topic of this episode of systemic racism. These are things that go together, that my role as a pastor and minister of the gospel and my role as as somebody who cares about the civics and the culture of our city as the director of the Camp House are one and the same and united fully when it comes to this issue. And so I created a post on Facebook yesterday that is intended to begin to educate particularly my fellow white people on what systemic racism is and what it looks like and how it has impacted our country since at least the Civil War. I mean, my post starts with the Civil War, but really for the 400 years of this country. In my article or post, I don't even mention what we did to the indigenous people of this nation, and that maybe that'll be a different episode sometime. But I really want to help people understand why there might be so much pain and why it might be so hard to understand. And it's largely because of a history of our country that you probably were never aware of. You certainly weren't taught this in school. I had a lot of people comment on the post that these are the things they've never heard before. And that's an indictment of our education system, of the way we've whitewashed the education system of our country, and the ways in which our country refuses to acknowledge its own sins. And that goes back to the very beginning. So I started my post centered around an image from the Times Free Press. And the image is a picture of protesters on Sunday night at the corner of Market and Fraser and Cherokee Boulevard. And my post had nothing to do with the article itself. I only cared about the picture. And I will probably use that picture for some of these posts that I do with this podcast episode so that you guys can see that and understand what I'm talking about. But I'm just going to read this post. And I might add some stuff to it because there's so many a few other things I've thought about in the meantime since this has been posted that I wish I had mentioned. So here it goes. Read this article if you wish, but this post is about the image and the tragic irony of African Americans protesting that Black Lives Matter at the corner of Market, Fraser, and Cherokee. You see, this corner at one time represented the threshold of one of the most empowered and free Black communities in our country. This corner was the threshold of a place known during the Civil War as Camp Contraband, where freed slaves gathered behind the Union line to serve the cause of freedom in whatever way they could, many becoming troops and others serving civil projects to advance the war effort. After the Civil War, Camp Contraband became Hill City, an established neighborhood with Black leadership and businesses. I found a book at the Chattanooga Public Library that was written in the book wasn't written in the 1870s, but this reporter was writing in the 1870s. And a traveling reporter at that time, during the time of Reconstruction, commented that the African-American schools of Hill City were some of the best organized schools he had seen in the entire South. And then Reconstruction ended. And here we are today, 150 years later, at the same place, fighting once again for the truth that Black lives matter. All of this simply proves Ibram X. Kendi's argument, and stamped from the beginning, that as long as racist ideas persist, so will systemic injustice. And I highly recommend this book, Stamped from the Beginning. It's big and it's dense and it takes a ton of time, but it is 100% worth it. The biggest takeaway, especially for me, from that book is this truth. Each and every time we've made racial progress in this country, every single time, there has been an equal racist backlash that limits or abolishes that progress. I want to say that again. Every time we've made racial progress in this country, in the United States, every single time, there has been an almost equal racist backlash that limits or abolishes that progress. And now I want to go through a history lesson of demonstrating that point. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery, only for a clause to allow the legal enslavement of black people by the state once white communities passed vagrancy laws. So we got rid of slavery, but as long as a white community could pass vagrancy laws that you can't be out after 8 p.m., they could be arrested and put into slave labor. The 14th Amendment gave due process to every citizen, only to allow for a system of cash bond that keeps poor black communities in an endless cycle of debt and poverty, regardless of whether they were proven guilty or innocent. The 15th Amendment gave all men the right to vote, only to give rise to literacy tests, poll taxes, and terror to maintain white power across our country and usher in 75 years of Jim Crow laws. Fast forward a bit to the 20th century. The GI Bill gave all veterans access to low-interest home loans that created the largest expansion of middle-class wealth and growth in American history, only to give rise to redlining that ensured that all of that money would be funneled to white-only neighborhoods and districts. And this is perhaps the greatest shift of wealth into white hands since the ending of slavery. And I write in parentheses, because from the beginning of our nation, all, capital A, capital L, capital L, all of our wealth was created on the backs of black bodies. From southern plantations, to the textile exchanges and stock markets of New York City, to the international shipping of sugar, tobacco, and cotton, all of our wealth for the first 200 years of this nation was created on the backs of black bodies. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 tried to equalize labor and integrate our schools, only for 60 to 70% of our black teachers to lose their jobs once those schools were integrated, creating multiple generations of African American and white children who have never had a black teacher. Unless, of course, your kids go to an urban school that is still largely segregated to this day, and you see a teacher turnover rate 3 to 4 times that of suburban schools. And the other thing in this period that I didn't mention in the article that I want to take a moment for is you can't underemphasize the amount of wealth that was created in the United States immediately after World War II. That is the moment that we became the most powerful nation and the wealthiest nation on earth. The entire world currency and gold exchange became based on the U.S. We owned within our country most of the gold in the world. And because of that, enormous sums of cash flooded into America. And again, I already mentioned the GI Bill and how that has overwhelmingly benefited white families. But the other thing is urban renewal projects of the 1950s through the 1970s completely changed our cities. And I haven't done this research to the fullest extent, and so I'm sure that this is a bit of an oversimplification. But when you look at every one of those urban renewal projects of that period, of those 20 years, it was created from a white vision that harmed black communities. Almost every single project of that time harmed black communities in some way. And so it was the rise of housing complexes and what we now call projects, all of which have been a massive social failure on almost every level. And our cities bear the scars of this white vision for our communities. Almost every infrastructure project from the beginning, you can actually look at it and you can ask the question, how has this benefited the white community and how has this harmed the black community? And so when you look at Chattanooga, when you look at our own city from the sky, you'll note two massive highways that create these scars through our city. And that's I-24 and State Highway 27. And here's what I mean. These were created at this time, and both of those projects accomplished the goal of developing an economy, of improving our GDP as a nation. And at the same time, they destroyed our Black communities in Chattanooga. And we still deal with the ramifications and what's left over from that. And so when you look at downtown, 27 carved our downtown in half. And the entire west side of our downtown is separated from the successful center city that we have. And the entire west side was an African-American community. Cameron Hill at one time had been this beautiful neighborhood, and it was destroyed in order to take the dirt and the soil from Cameron Hill, the place where Blue Cross is right now. They took that soil to create the ridge cut for I-24 that cuts through our city. And you look at I-24 separated the southern half of our city. And so now the area we call Southside along Main Street isn't the real south side of our city. The real south side is below I-24, and it's largely poor Black communities that have been separated because of this massive infrastructure project from the success of our downtown. Urban renewal projects specifically targeted poor African-American neighborhood after poor African-American neighborhood throughout our entire country. And we haven't recovered from that. And so at the same moment that white families were getting cheap home loans to create the suburbs, our African-American neighbors were having their homes taken from them and were instead given these horrible housing projects that were uniform and they were ugly from the very beginning. And so our Black communities have suffered. Since the 1970s, the wealth gap only grew because those same white families who took advantage of the GI Bill could sell the first home they ever owned. They could sell that for the very first time and pass that money on to their children. Since the 1980s, the war against drugs turned our country into a nation of prisons. And we have the highest incarceration rate in the world, boasting 25% of the world's prisoners in 2020. Now, to be fair, that probably doesn't include China. And since the war on drugs and the terrorist attacks of 2001, we have militarized every police department in America, teaching our police officers that the people they have sworn to serve are the greatest enemy they will face each and every day. And so within the next couple of decades since that, we see what that has given us. Police trained in such a way that they use lethal force in seemingly benign situations. And to be honest, that lethal force was probably always there, but now with social media, we witness it firsthand. Granted, there may be moments where force is needed, but it obviously wasn't so for George Floyd or Breonna Taylor or Eric Garner or Michael Brown or so many others. And that's just been in the last 5 years. Now, I want to point something out, and I do this in the post, in parentheses. This is not to say that every police officer is bad or evil. Of course not. But I would argue that their formation as officers has taught them an ethic that leads to the death of Black people. Their formation as officers has taught them an ethic that leads to the death of Black people. This is why at the Camp House, we support the incredible work of Chattanooga's Police Department, their academy, where every cadet must spend time in a minority community reporting on their experience before they are sworn in to serve that community. I want you to hear that again. In Chattanooga, you know, right now there's so many riots and stuff happening in Chattanooga, and I think people, there's been a couple bad experiences, but our own CPD has been incredible. Even David Roddy, you know, was one of the first out there to say that if you think it's okay to put your knee on somebody's neck, then please turn in your badge. Since Fred Fletcher, our police department has this incredible academy program where every cadet must go spend time in the African American community, in the LGBT community, in the mental health community, in the Latino community, and they must report back on their experience of getting to know that community. What is it you didn't know about them before? What is it you know now? And they make so many different connections. That's an unbelievable program. And so I deeply appreciate men and women like Fred Fletcher, Chief David Roddy, Assistant Chief Glenn Scruggs, and Assistant Chief Dana Vaughn. So back to the post. Throw on top all of that the supposed vigilante justice that the white community has afflicted upon the black community, from slavery to lynchings in the 20th century to two white men shooting Ahmaud Arbery because they suspected him of a crime. This list is not exhaustive. There are plenty of sources out there to read about this, and I'll post some links in the notes to this podcast episode. There's also plenty of stories of redemption. This is why African Americans are angry and in pain. This is what systemic racism is. Please, if you haven't, when you hear a systemic racism and you see a bigot in your head, get that out of your head. That's not it. That is racism. But systemic racism and systemic injustice exists in our institutions. Our country is broken and sick. It has been since its foundation. And dear God, I didn't even talk about the indigenous people of this country. White supremacy is not only an individual sin, but a corporate sin alive and well in the systems that we have created and perpetrated in the United States. It is an evil that we have not yet fully reckoned with, and we have not yet fully repented of. And so, Father, forgive us. And I ended my post with a prayer from Satoya Foster, a woman, a dear leader within our church at the Mission Chattanooga. And during the service on Sunday, she posted this prayer in the comment section that's in response both to this moment of racial trauma and the fact that this past Sunday was Pentecost. And it's this. Lord, I pray that we value the bodies that your Holy Spirit lives inside of, the same Spirit that connects us with you and with one another. Thank you all for reading this. Thank you all for watching. Thank you all for listening. Like I said, I really want this to be an opportunity for us as the white community to better understand what systemic racism is, how it's impacted our African-American brothers and sisters, and how our communities are still living with and experiencing the damage of well over 200 years of policies. Again, Ibram Kendi's thesis is that for every moment of racial progress we have in this country, there comes an equal racist backlash that either limits or abolishes that progress. And that is why we live in a country today where the average African American family or individual has a life wealth significantly lower than their white counterparts, regardless of education level. It's why our black neighborhoods are consistently the poorest neighborhoods in our city. And until we begin to understand that, until we can actually look at our history and learn our history, our real history, not what you were taught in high school, I'd be surprised if you even learned half of what I said in a college class. Until we can learn our real history, I'm not sure we can even understand the implications of our actions today and what they will have in the future. So again, if this is an I hope this is an introduction. Maybe you guys already knew this, and awesome. And there's so many other resources out there to keep this conversation going, to keep learning. And that's really what I want to encourage everybody to do, is to keep learning and keep supporting. I want to give a shout out and thank you to so many people who helped me on this journey to this point. So many people that I've worked with at the camp house, not the least of which was Shane Morrow and James McKissick. We've worked together and done cultural events for over 8 years now. The friends I made at the Bessie Smith Cultural Center when we were on MLK there, spending time organizing a business association along MLK was an invaluable lesson of getting to know some of the black business owners we have in the city. You know, within the Mission Chattanooga, there have been some incredible people. Chris Woodhall, Donovan Brown, David Deerdorf, Grace Alexander, who have really helped to lead our staff through these conversations. And I don't know that I could have posted any of this without them. Unlearning these things takes a lot of time, and it's worth it. For the sake of our neighbors, it's worth it. So thank you all for tuning in. Please share this with people. Share this with people. Black Lives Matter.